It's a great pleasure to have David, who was supposed to visit PI, but has to give this remote seminar, the first of our series of quantum fields and string. And he'll be talking about ISCOs in ADS CFT. So David, take it away.
Yes, thank you. So thank you for having me. I know it's nicer in person, but this is the best we can do in these hard times. I'll talk about ISCOs in ADS CFT. ISCOs is innermost stable circular orbits. This is a standard acronym in gravity. The work I'm presenting today is based on joint work with John Simon, which has already been published and it showed up on the archive in October, and work in progress with C.G. Lee, who goes by Fraser because his name is actually hard to pronounce, and John Simon. Z is an undergraduate student that's working with me right now. Okay, so let me start by, and everyone can ask questions whenever they want to. So let me start about talking about two related problems. The first problem is a standard story of ADS CFT. We usually perturb the boundary and we have a source for waves that propagate into the interior. And this is the Gubser-Krebenhoff-Polyakov-Witten dictionary, in that whenever we do something on the boundary, it propagates into the bulk and that's how we generate states. So we have a source on the boundary and that's a boundary condition on the gravity theory. And then we have to solve the gravity theory in the bulk. And the problem is that, or if you actually want to build local fields, you can also go with the HKLL prescription, which basically gives a kernel to build fields in the bulk from operator insertions on the boundary. And the problem is that you have to integrate this kernel over time, so it's a non-local operator in time. And this is sometimes complicated to understand quantum mechanics. And then when you include interactions in the bulk, you need to correct this order by order in perturbation theory, and it becomes non-linearly corrected to higher orders as a power series in H-bar. The kernel K that shows up here also depends on the background metric in the bulk. So what happens is that the bulk fields or exciting things in the bulk depends on knowing the bulk a priori. And on top of that, it's a non-local construction in time because you have to integrate the operator insertions over a window of time to get the physics to work. Okay, the problem is really that the operators that we put on the boundary can have dimension delta bigger than D. And if you look at this from the point of view of renormalization, these are irrelevant perturbations. So when you integrate operators that are irrelevant in the boundary, you have a very badly behaved UV problem. And on the gravity side, if you do it naively, you get an infinite back reaction because you're injecting an infinite amount of energy. And this suggests that to the extent that you can work with HKLL, and these insertions are only well-defined in a perturbation series sense, and you cannot fix that. So this is the first problem. And then if you think about a very massive particle in the bulk, and you need to kind of create it there, you basically need to interfere an incoming pulse to cancel all the bad behavior in the UV to generate the localized excitation. So this is in some sense the problem of renormalization of how do you make sure that you got finite energy in the bulk where you want it, rather than an infinite amount of energy that you need to interfere away to get a sensible quantum physics. Okay. The dual problem, or the second problem is, you know, what's the CFT dual to geodesics in the bulk? So if you have a geodesic in the bulk, how do you prepare a state that probes exactly that geodesic and not anyone else? How do you prepare a state where you have a particle that is located on your geodesic of choice in a way that in some sense does not suffer from these infinities non-perturbatively? Okay, so these are the problems. And if you're asking this question, you might as well ask what geodesics are special in a black hole background. And this is where, what is the dual to ISCOs in ADS CFT? And ISCOs is the standard acronym for the innermost stable circular orbit, which is a property of Schwarzschild black holes in 3+1 dimensions. They don't show up in higher dimensions in flat Minkowski backgrounds, or in flat in black holes in flat space, but they do show up again for black holes in ADS. Okay, so if anyone has any questions, just stop me as I'm going and I'll answer that. So the rest of the talk will be about dealing with, some Hamiltonian problems or properties of states created by operators at fixed time, try to understand those amplitudes better and how to regularize them. And basically, once you regularize them, what's the physics of the cutoff? So how do you control for the energy of the state? And then basically, I'll show you that one can go from the physics of the boundary that starts in the Hamiltonian formalism and turn it into a semi-classical limit in ADS, where one asks what's a corresponding geodesic that has the same energy and that corresponds to semi-classical motion of the state that we created in the boundary. And I'll show how that goes, both from the Hamiltonian and from the path integral point of view. So eventually we'll go to a path integral derivation of what's going on, or an understanding of what's going on. And then basically we'll add black holes to the mix and follow the same type of ideas. And we'll talk about ISCOs and other circular orbits, and what's the dual physics, and some conclusions. Okay, so we're gonna talk about operator matrix elements first. The way this works is that you want to imagine smearing an operator insertion in space, but not on time. So if you have a confirmed field theory on the cylinder, you can integrate the operator over the angles, and that smears it in space, and you've generated a state this way. And the state that you have generated this way is a sum over the descendants of the operator O at fixed time t. And here I'm using liberally the operator state correspondence that says that to every operator insertion, you can associate a state. So this operator insertion corresponds to states that are spherically symmetric because of the integral over the angles. And then you have to think about it as an S wave. And then we can project onto the individual states to obtain the matrix elements of this operator insertion. And you can use Euclidean two-point functions of the operators to extract this information. We did this a while ago with Alexander Miller in 2014. So you can think of the spherically symmetric descendants of O as box to the kth power acting on O. And these are operators of dimension delta plus 2k. The 2k is just from the dimension of the box operator. And then you're acting on the ground state, and there's a typo here, it should be the ground state operator, a little bit better presented. But the idea is you integrate these acting on the ground state, and these give you the amplitudes to generate the descendants of the operator. And these can be computed. The result is finite for each one of these descendants. So it's not that any one matrix element to a particular state in the energy basis is infinite, they're all finite. It's governed by gamma functions and then some factors of pi and other extraneous stuff. This is the important stuff. The amplitude square can be computed with gamma functions, and we will be interested in the limit where delta is large and at large k. So the natural place to go to is to estimate these using the Stirling's approximation for the gamma function. So you can check that the total state generated is non-normalizable, meaning this sum is infinite most of the time. And more precisely, if you go to this limit of the Stirling's approximation, you find that this amplitude squared scales like some exponential of the log of k with some prefactor, which is 2 delta minus d in front of the log, which means that these amplitudes are only growing polynomially for all operator dimensions. And this is useful to know. So when you use Stirling's approximation, the factorial growth that grow exponentially cancel, and the stuff that's non-exponential is the stuff that survives, and it's just an exponential of a log rather than this double exponential. So it's polynomial growth rather than exponential growth of these amplitudes. So if you have an amplitude that is polynomially growing, you can check when you converge, and it converges when the sum is less than infinity. So the sum or the state is normalizable if the dimension is less than d minus 1 over 2. And most operator dimensions are bigger than d minus 1 over 2. Actually, most of them are bigger than d. So the window of opportunity for anything interesting happening just without normalizing the operators or without a UV cutoff is actually very small. So the idea is if you have a very massive particle, it will correspond to a large dimension. And then these naive insertion of states, even after smearing on space, is not normalizable. So the next step is to just regularize that and to notice that if you have a polynomial growth, any small exponential decay can cut it off and make it finite. So we basically modify these amplitudes. We define a new operator where we modify the amplitudes based on a UV regulator that basically cuts off the UV mods exponentially. And we just define states this way. And this actually corresponds to conjugating the Hamiltonian in Euclidean time to regularize the operator insertions. So if you act with this operator on the ground state, and let's say the ground state has your energy, the exponential to plus epsilon h acting on the ground state gives 1. And then this exponential to minus epsilon h is the stuff that generates this exponential decay of the amplitudes over here. So what we're saying is that there's a new way to regulate these operators, which depend on this parameter epsilon, which is a small Euclidean time evolution because of this conjugation by the Hamiltonian. And then this has also been considered in local quenches by Takayanagi in various papers with various collaborators throughout the years. Okay, so we have these insertions, and the goal now is if you compute the norm and the energy, they're now finite, but they depend on the regulator parameter epsilon. And now this works for operators of arbitrarily high dimension. And we want to understand the physics of this regulator, especially for large delta. So our goal is to try to understand what happens when you insert operators of large dimension in the conformal field theory. Okay, so the flow of time is you have real time, and when you insert this operator, you flow in imaginary time for a little bit, you insert the operator, you flow back out again, and you continue in real time. So the idea is, if you want to think about this from the point of view of path integrals, you're doing a non-standard contour where there's real time and imaginary time flow, and you have these zigzags inside. And it's this imaginary time that actually is helping you regulate the theory. Okay, so the question we're going to ask is, what's the most likely excited state? And now that we have the amplitudes, we can just minimize in the Stirling's approximation and see what we get. So because we're doing it straight with the amplitudes and we started in the operator formalism, this is a Hamiltonian formalism because we've computed the operator amplitudes already. So you just take the modified amplitude squared, you get these 2 delta minus d log k, and then you have minus 2 epsilon 2 k plus delta, and you get this factor of 2 because you've squared the amplitude. So when we compute the saddle in the amplitude for k, this is a straightforward calculation, you get that the maximum value of k is 2 delta minus d over 4 epsilon, and that means that the energy is 2 k max plus delta. And then if you take epsilon to 0, the k max goes to infinity and the energy goes to infinity again. And here you see that when delta is bigger than d over 2, then the k max goes to infinity. And when delta is less than d over 2, the k max will go to minus infinity. What that means is that the Stirling's approximation has broken down and you have to go near k equal to zero to understand the physics. Now, so this is the statement. We have epsilon, we have a value of k, and we have the energy, and if we have the energy, we can try to understand what's going on. You can also compute the variance. So the variance tells you that delta k over k max squared is suppressed in 1 over delta. So one way to think about it is that when delta gets big, the variance in the energy is small, and the physics becomes semi-classical. So this relative variance is small for operators of large dimension. And what you have to understand is that there's an h bar here and in here. And this is easier to understand in anti-zero space. So you can think of this insertion for large delta as being a fixed classical energy because of this small uncertainty. So let's go to a semi-classical physics on ADS that corresponds to the same energy. So if you have an operator of dimension delta, you can convert it to a mass. The mass is in units of ADS. So if you have square root of delta, delta minus D, and you expand it in Taylor series for delta large, then you get delta minus D half. So delta and M are pretty much the same thing. And there's these D halves over here. The difference between delta and M, these D halves, is a zero point energy for a particle that's been localized due to the gravitational potential. So delta and M are roughly the same. If you want to think about a classical mass that doesn't have an H bar, you need to scale M in such a way that H bar M becomes M classical, and then this gives you a notion of what's going on. So a classical mass corresponds to delta going to infinity, so that H bar times delta is kept fixed. So classical masses are equivalent to large dimension, and then the fluctuations in the energy become of order h bar in these units, and it's appropriate to think about these processes semi-classically in anti-zero space. So we started with an S wave, and the way you're supposed to think about it is that you need to look for classical motion that has no angular momentum. So what you need is a radial geodesic. So if you take a point particle and you go on a radial geodesic, there's only two coordinates, the radial coordinate and the time coordinate, and then the angular coordinates go away because there's no angular velocity. So the action for a point particle becomes easy to understand. It's this integral over proper time, over the time of the square root of cosine hyperbolic squared of rho minus rho dot squared, and then use the gauge where the time is equal to tau, so that this dt d tau squared that shows up over here goes away. So this is the action, and then it's written in a special set of coordinates, which is the global coordinates. Okay, so if you match the energy of the classical particle to the Hamiltonian computation in the CFT side, you say that the energy needs to be mass times the conserved energy of the classical trajectory, and then you need to pick a value where rho dot vanishes, and then that basically specifies the radial position, which is the turning point of the orbit. So you can convert the energy to a radial turning point of the orbit, which is defined by this rho star. So you define basically a radial position from the turning point of the trajectory. Now the idea is that when we computed the amplitudes in the CFT, they were all real. And if you think of a system that has time reversal symmetry, which many systems do, then the state that you've generated is consistent with being time reversal symmetric. And then when you go to the ADS side, you ask which points in the radial geodesic are time symmetric invariant. And there's only two of them when you're strictly at the origin and when you're at the turning point of the radial direction in the bulk. And then the point is that the one that's at the center of ADS has a very large velocity. And what you're actually doing is you're really picking the one that is the turning point of the radial trajectory. The velocity by itself is not time symmetric invariant. It has a sign when you change when you do time conjugation. So the upshot is that we inject the energy at the turning point of the radial geodesic. So if you match the radial size to the parameter epsilon that we had in the energy, you can turn the cosine hyperbolic of rho to a function that depends on epsilon. And when you divide by delta everything, you find that the radial position depends only on this parameter epsilon, but stops depending on the dimension of the operator. So what that means is that this regulator has a geometric interpretation in that fixing this epsilon gives rise to a unique radial position where you are trying to insert the energy. And this is the same idea that Takayama et al. Had, except that we're doing it in the cylinder rather than on the flat Poincaré slicing of ADS or of the conformal field theory. Okay. So if you compute the radial fluctuations, you can compute them from the fluctuations in the energy. They're small. And then what you see is that the radial fluctuations in ABS units go like 1/√m. The Compton wavelength is 1/m. But the point is that these type of fluctuations are the same that you get when you insert the particle at rest at the insertion point. So this distance is much larger than the Compton wavelength. So the velocity that you insert the particle at is small, and this is justified by this uncertainty computation. So you can basically be pretty sure that you're tuning in onto the correct radial geodesic, and that the fluctuations are not large relative to it. The side note is that if you have these delta x of order 1/√m, is the same spatial uncertainty of a point particle of mass m inserted at the bottom of global ADS in the ground state. So that's important because it tells you that this is about as small uncertainty as you can possibly get with this insertion. Okay, so we did an imaginary time Hamiltonian evolution. So the question is, how do we do this in the pint integral? And you're supposed to think about it in terms of tunneling. So we're going to think of tunneling in ADS. So here you have ADS written as a tin can. Here you have the boundary of ADS, which is a sphere. We're inserting the operator in Euclidean time at some distance from the t equal to 0 slides. So this is where we do that. And then the particle tunnels into the appropriate turning point of the radial geodesic. And then the idea is that the distance that you've tunneled through is L star in these coordinates. And then you've tunneled the distance rho star from the origin, which is what we found from the Hamiltonian calculation. So the Hamiltonian calculation gave us rho star. You're supposed to think about it as tunneling from the boundary to rho star. The amplitude that we computed in the Hamiltonian formalism grows exponentially, like exponential of m rho star. So the maximum amplitude when you evaluate at the saddle point looks like this. And then this is like tunneling because this looks like exponential to minus L star, where minus rho star is L star minus L. So the idea is that if you take rho star is the negative of L star, L minus L star. And then this minus L star is what's giving you a behavior that looks like tunneling. So this suggests that we actually do a proper tunneling computation and match the result. So you study a geodesic from the boundary to an insertion point in ADS. And when you study the geodesic, you have to regulate it by removing the distance from the origin to some point in the geodesic and taking the limit as you take that point to infinity. You do that, and you find that this L star that gets regulated is simple, meaning that it goes like the log of this sine hyperbolic of rho star. And for rho star large, which is equivalent to epsilon small, this grows like rho star, and it's looking just like it should. So the regulated L star is behaving exactly like minus rho star, and we're getting exactly the physics that we want. Okay, now we can add angular momentum. So when you add an operator insertion at any one point on the boundary, you have to remember that you're basically generating a Taylor series of all the possible descendants of the operator O. So you can project onto states of fixed angular momentum by just adding a spherical harmonic. So you can basically think of taking the same operator insertion by integrating with a spherical harmonic, and that way obtaining the descendants of the operator O that have angular momentum. And you can do a computation that finds the same amplitude. It's also found in some computations of Kaplan and Fitzpatrick and Terashima, and there's even some older work by Kotayasku of 99 that has some of this information. And the way they do it is they compute Green's functions from the bulk to the boundary to compute these amplitudes. But the Hamiltonian and the ADS computation give the same answer from the point of view of just wave functions and ADS to representations of the conformal group on the boundary. Okay, so again, we can use Stirling. And the idea is that when you use the Stirling approximation, you need to keep the fact that you have non-trivial angular momentum. And you can find geodesics where the K is modified if the L that you have, the angular momentum, scales in the same way that the maximum K does. And that way you start modifying the nature of the geodesic, meaning that you don't take a small L, you need to do a double scaling limit where L and the maximum K that we had before scale together in the same way. So to get a non-trivial amount of angular momentum in the bulk, it needs to be comparable, or the energy due to angular momentum needs to be comparable to the energy due to the radial position or to the radial motion. And then between these two, you can get a non-trivial modification. The full ADS dual for that computation is we need to solve for geodesics with fixed angular momentum and energy for classical configurations. So the angular momentum L becomes the J of the descendants divided by the mass of the particle, and the energy is E divided by the mass of the particle. And what we need to keep is L and E, little L and little E fixed, as we take J and E to infinity and M to infinity in a way that this ratio stays fixed. So we get a turning point equation. This should be a small e squared. I didn't fix all my notation apparently. But the idea is you just set rho dot equal to zero and you solve for rho, and then what you find is some non-trivial equation, and it's a quadratic equation that you need to solve, and you get two turning points. So for this to be similar to what we did for the infalling radial geodesic, for very small angular momentum, it should be the same as before. So it should be on a turning point of the geodesic, which is the farthest from the origin. And then the same idea of things looking more or less time symmetric suggests that we just insert it at the point that is farthest away from the origin in the trajectory. And then when you compute the uncertainty in the angles and the energy, you get something similar. So this is also a minimal uncertainty insertion in the radial direction. So here's the idea. You have a closed orbit in ADS, and you're tunneling from the boundary with some non-trivial integration over the spherical harmonics, and you tunnel to the point of the orbit that is at maximum distance from the origin. And then the idea is that when you use these operators this way, you've generated initial conditions for particles on this geodesic. If you want to generate a particle that is further along the geodesic, you first tunnel here, and then you let it evolve in real time to where you want it to be on the trajectory. So that lets you prepare initial states that have particles at arbitrary locations under geodesic motion with arbitrary control of their motion. Once you have them, in principle, you can do things like scattering of the geodesics, meaning you take two particles on geodesics and make them go against each other and have collisions. And in principle, you can do that type of experiment. What I'm interested on right now is something a bit more pedestrian, is just to understand what the physics that we've found so far is. We inserted at an instant of time, meaning we had an operator description of what we've inserted. The proper instant of time is on a Euclidean continuation. There's no integrations over time, but there is integrations over the angles in contrast to HKLL. We've produced finite energy particles excitations with excitations on ADS that are smaller than the ADS radius, but much larger than the Compton wavelength of the particles we've inserted, at something that approaches minimal uncertainty, meaning that they're essentially about as classical as it gets. These operators are non-perturbatively well-defined. Nowhere in the calculation did I need to use the fact that the states were perturbative operators. This statement about operators and representation theory is true regardless of the conformal field theory being weak coupling or strong coupling, or whether we're doing this as a perturbation theory or not. The insertion in the bulk was guaranteed to work fine. The regulator is physical, meaning that when you add the regulator, you're have a geometric interpretation, and you're actually acting on the field theory or on the gravity side in a particular locus on the radial direction. And it's good for initial conditions because everything is Gaussian localized, meaning minimal uncertainty to the extent that it's possible. Okay, so this is what happens for a single particle in ADS. Now we're just going to add black holes, and we're going to assume that everything carries the same way.
David?
Yes.
Can I ask you a question? You went over the angular momentum case pretty quickly. When there was no angular momentum, I could recognize it as, you know, you had this Euclidean geodesic that was telling me about the tunneling, and that connected to a real Lorentzian. And do you want to say a few more words what's going on here with angular momentum?
So let me go back to where... Did I have the angular momentum? Did I do this already? No, I went too... Okay, I went too far back. Here we go. What happens is that we have these computations for angular momentum. Okay?
Yeah.
So what you can do here is go back to my geodesic equation over here and compute the geodesic with the angular momentum fixed. So take the action, put in the angular momentum, and just plug in the correct value and just do this integral. And this is what should compute that geodesic. So the idea is that...
That's the Lorentzian orbit that you're...
Right. So the idea is, how do you go from a Lorentzian orbit with a fixed angular momentum to a Euclidean one? You just take an imaginary continuation of the angular momentum at the same value of angular momentum with a factor of I stuck in. So what you're going to do is, on the ADS side, when you have an angle insertion, the angle will become imaginary. But what you do is you do the calculation at fixed angular momentum and solve that problem. If you want to go fancy, you go to a Ruthian, but it's a lot simpler just to think about it as a Hamiltonian formulation or the Hamiltonian constraint, and you just invert the potential for angular momentum.
Oh, okay.
And that's actually the simple way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't know if that answered your question, but
I think I get it now. Yeah.
Yeah. So
actually, can I ask another? Since I disturbed you.
No, that's good.
You have sort of the aphelion, but you also have the I don't know why it's a helium.
Perihelion.
But
you also have and the perihelion.
The perihelion. Is there are you solving a quadratic equation somewhere and you could choose either of those as the point you're going to?
That will become clearer in the future.
Okay.
But the idea is that you do have two points where in principle you could be tunneling on two. Uh-huh. And then when I do things in the black hole, it becomes evident why you should tunnel to one and not the other.
Okay, sure.
Okay. Right. So let's do the black hole. So we do the same thing. We have the black hole, go Euclidean, integrate with some spherical harmonic, the operator. And this is the stuff that we're doing right now. And then the first goal is to just find simple geodesics, like rotating geodesics in the black hole. Okay. So how do you find them? The first thing you need to do is we need to use a different set of coordinates than global ADS coordinates. We use standard coordinates that show up in ADS Schwarzschild. The radial geodesic before was really good at giving us some intuition of how to measure proper distances on the regulator, but standard ADS Schwarzschild coordinates are way more convenient for a lot of computations going forward. Okay, so first thing we do is we put the black hole. The classical analysis is you take classical trajectories and you go to the constraint equation. And then in the constraint equation, you have the energy, you have the angular momentum, and you have the constraint, which has the motion in the radial direction, plus the things that are conserved, you could do killing vectors in the bulk and whatnot. And what you see is that the energy squared goes like the angular momentum squared. This is standard ADS physics. There's this L squared over R squared plus R squared. That's global ADS physics. And then there's the pieces that have the mass, and that is the correction due to having the black hole. And they have different scaling with the radials than the classical pieces in ADS. So, and there's a mass in here. And this is of the form R dot squared plus some effective potential, and the effective potential depends on the angular momentum. Okay, so let's do classical physics with this. This is how it looks. You have an effective potential. It goes up near the boundary of ADS. This is the standard gravitational potential. Here you have a bump. This is the standard angular momentum repulsion. And then it bends over and comes inside, which is the standard feature of Einstein gravity, that gravitational potential is really strong as you get closer to the horizon and it sucks everything in. So the potential kind of behaves this way. And then what you have is something that looks like a potential barrier. The ADS boundary on the left, the horizon on the right. And this is the classical picture of the constraint that says that the proper time on the geodesic is equal to the time parameter of some version of the Hamiltonian. This is what this constraint can be thought of, because the R dot here squared is R dot with respect to proper time. Okay, so we have this here, and now this is where we do a calculation. If you have a circular orbit, you're at the minimum of the potential over here, or you're at the maximum over here. You have two possibilities, but if you fix the radius, the angular momentum can be determined from the radial position. And then usually you want to determine the radius from the angular momentum, but here what you determine is the angular momentum from the radius, and then the inversion gives you a multivalued function. So for each angular momentum, there's more than one turning point, or more than one circular geodesic. One of them is this stable geodesic, and the other one is this unstable geodesic over here. Okay. The circular orbits stop existing when this angular momentum square goes negative. So what that means is there's a value of r where this r d to the d minus dm r squared is equal to zero. And then you can ask, what's the physics of that? And after scratching our hands a little bit, we realized that this is actually the light ring of the black hole, that the circular orbits stop existing when you actually go faster than the speed of light. And then the angular momentum at that point goes to infinity. But more precisely, it goes to infinity. So if you take the mass to zero, you can keep finite values, but the radius stays at some position. And then when you compute null geodesics, you find that this is the location of the light ring. And then it only exists for d bigger than 2. So this is ADS3, ADS4, ADS5, but not in ADS3. That's where d would be equal to 2. The geodesics are stable when the second derivative of the potential at R is bigger than zero. And then you're at the innermost stable circular orbit exactly when you're at the critical point of V where the second derivative vanishes. And then when you get the equations, they're pretty nasty. So I'm not going to write them for you because you don't get much insight from that information. You basically have to take the derivative of this potential that we had here with respect to R twice, and V prime has to be equal to zero. That fixes L as a function of R. And then you have the second derivative with fixed L, and then that second partial derivative is pretty nasty, and then solving them both together is not algebraically possible in any nice way. But the point is that from this equation, we get a scaling of the radius that says the radius should scale like m to the 1 over d minus 2. So let's try to understand what happens with the scaling. The most interesting limit is just go to a large mass limit. That'll be high temperature in the dual CFT. And what we want to understand is what this scaling does to all of the physics that we have. So large M is equivalent to large temperature in CFT. So this is just translating the mass of the black hole to a temperature. So what happens there is we use that scaling. The R squared scales as M to 2 over D minus 2. The L squared over R squared scales the same way. M times L squared R to the minus D scales like M to the fourth over D minus 2, and then M to the R to the minus D minus 2, this one that shows up in the potential, scales like M to 0, and this one is the most subleading, so you throw that one away, you throw away the term that are not nice, or the ones that are most subleading, and you keep the leading terms. You can actually find an analytic solution for ISCO, which says that the innermost stable circular orbit has the same scaling M to the 1 over D minus 2 that came from the light ring. So this is farther away than the light ring, but what we have here is a solution to the circular orbit, the last one that is stable, with a particular scaling with the mass M. Okay. The radius of the horizon scale is like M to the 1 over D. So M to the 1 over D relative to M to the 1 over D minus 2 when M is very large means that the radius of the ISCO is much, much larger than the radius of the horizon. So the way you're supposed to think geometrically about what happens in the large temperature limit is that the existence of these orbits are pushed very far away from the horizon as you increase the temperature. So much so that if you take the scaling limit towards the planar black hole, the energy and the angular momentum of these classical trajectories scale like t to the 2d over d minus 2. And then you multiply by the dimension of the operator to get the proper energy and proper angular momentum of these states. So if you actually look at a paper of Festucci and Liu, they have this statement somewhere in there buried because they were studying quasi-normal modes of particles in the ADS black hole, and then they were using these tunneling trajectories, but they never explained what the physics of this is. They just said, oh, it's a puzzle. So it took us a while to figure this out. After 2 months, we found that they actually had done this. This is usually what happens. Every time you discover something neat, it's pretty surprising that nobody else has done it before. So it's there, out there. But the point is that this scales a lot faster than T. So if you take the limit to the term of field theory, the fact that these modes scale like a high power of the temperature means that they disappear, or more precisely, thermal excitation scale like T, these scale like a much higher power of T. So in the large temperature limit, they go away. They're very much more energetic than thermal. So basically you can say that they have the wrong units on the boundary. So if you have the wrong units, you have to fix it with something. So here's the physics. What other scale do we have on the boundary, which is not the temperature? And then we have the sphere of the cylinder, and we have time. Time goes on forever. There's no scale associated to time. So the only other scale that we have is the radius of the sphere. the radius of curvature of the sphere. So how to fix the units? You basically need to put the radius of the sphere in the right place to get units of energy. So it actually must be the curvature of the spatial boundary in CFT because the effect is absent in BTC. You look at BTC in 2+1 dimensions, the boundary is a circle with no curvature times time, so it's a flat geometry. And when you look in the bulk, there's no stable geodesics and there's no circular geodesics that are stable at all. And this is a well-known result that dates back to the time of BTC, when people were studying the classical geodesics of BTC, when BTC was found. Okay? So the idea is that if it's not there in 1+1 dimensions, but it's there in 2+1 dimensions or higher for the field theory, what distinguishes that circle from the sphere is the presence of curvature. So this is an effect which in the dual CFT is sourced by curvature. Now let's go back to ADS. And now to do ADS and do tunneling, you have to take the same potential barrier and you need to invert it, meaning you flip the potential upside down. And then you start on the boundary and you ask, where do I tunnel to? So if I have any one of these orbits that are stable and I'm starting from the boundary, I first tunnel to the closest point to the boundary, and then I would have real-time evolution, and then I would end up going on the inside boundary. So Rob, when you were asking about the aphelion versus the perihelion, if you fix some energy and you tunnel to that energy, you tunnel to the first available locus that's compatible with going to real evolution from where you start, which is the boundary, rather than going through that and having a wave function that is oscillatory in the center. So when we compute the tunneling stuff, it's usually the part where you're going through the barrier, but not the part where you're not in the barrier. And this is the same way we do things, for example, in inflation. When you tunnel in inflation, you tunnel to the first point that's available on the potential of the Big Bang universe. Okay, so here's what's important. If you tunnel to very high energy, now you need to imagine that you've inverted the potential. You've tunneled to so much energy that once you've tunneled here, you're gonna roll down the hill and you're gonna overshoot and you're gonna fall into a black hole. So if you tunnel with very high energy, you fall into a black hole. If you tunnel, if you try to tunnel with very small energy, you would try to target these trajectories over here on the inside of the black hole, you would also fall to the black hole. But there's a catch. You can tunnel onto stable trajectories from the classical point of view only if you're in this band of energy. So there's a band of stability of these configurations. If you go fully quantum, you can always tunnel inside. So at most, these configurations are metastable. And there's actually two effects that give you metastability. One of them is that you can tunnel through. This is quantum mechanical. But the other one is that if you're in a circular orbit, you can have gravitational radiation. So in principle, you could radiate gravitationally and get closer and closer to the ISCO. And when you get to the ISCO, you fall down. And this is the same way that you would accrete into a black hole. So there's two ways on how to fall into a black hole after that. One of them is just tunnel. The other one is you radiate stuff and then fall through the black hole as in an accretion process. In any case, the band is there. It'll be long-lived from the point of view of the thermal scale in ADS because this is very, very far away from the original problem. And these timescales are very different than thermal timescales. Okay. So when you compute the radius as a function of angular momentum, it's not single valued. We see this here. There's two values of R for the same angular momentum. More to the point, you can have more than one trajectory for fixed Euclidean time. And this is where it becomes important in that when you try to tunnel to this point over here, you find that the tunneling time in the Euclidean time goes to infinity because you have to stay at the top of the potential for a very long time. So if you go to this prescription where we had a Euclidean time, there's a geodesic that wants to go to infinite Euclidean time. But if you're studying geodesics on the black hole in Euclidean time, you should actually do it on the cigar geometry. And then there's a maximum Euclidean time that you can go through. And then if you try to go past that Euclidean time, what you find is that there's another geodesic that starts contributing. Since here you go to infinity, when you try to tunnel to the other side, you go from infinity back down. So a geodesic here at finite Euclidean time would compete with a geodesic that goes here. And the action for the geodesic that gets you closer to the boundary is a lot smaller than the one that gets you all the way inside. So when you tunnel, you actually tunnel to the outside orbits that are available to you rather than to the inside. You don't control energy directly. What you control is this epsilon parameter in the operator insertion. So some of these geodesics that are inside here, I think we will not really have access to directly with these operators unless one does something very fancy. Okay.
Yes. David, can I just ask, so are you saying that it's not physically possible to get to that metastable orbit?
Well, these are non-metastable over here.
That one there.
This one, actually, yes, because the epsilon is of order the temperature, and then you're going to get very, very close to this one.
Okay.
So you get almost there.
Okay.
Like you have to measure it in the time scale of the corresponding orbit, which needs to be compared to the temperature. Yeah. But the point is that if you go to exactly the orbit that's sitting there, you end up going to a time that goes to infinity because you're just sitting at the top of the hill forever.
Yes.
So the idea is that the Euclidean time goes to infinity when you really want to just go exactly to that orbit with nothing else. If you allow for a very small amount of energy that's over or the order of the temperature, which is very small compared to what you're doing here, it's fine, and you tunnel here, and you're going to have a very small oscillation right here. It's not going to make a difference. Okay, so you can almost get to the orbit that you want exactly, not quite necessarily on the nose, but good enough.
Yes.
You pay a small price, but not, you know, it's as good as it gets from this point of view. If you want to do something very precise, then you have to do something else. Okay, but here's the point. You tunnel above the potential hump, it's in some sense not allowed because another geodesic with the same endpoints in Euclidean time dominates, which brings you back to some point over here. And basically, the other geodesic, just the one that falls into the black hole, is harder to access. I still don't know how to do that. But in any case, here we go. So what's the predictions that we got for CFT? We got these band of metastable orbits. What that translates to is for each dimension of the operator, there's a band of regularized operators that produce tunneling into the appropriate geodesics. So each one of the operators will generate a band. The band exists only because of curvature on the CFT side that you've coupled the background to, or you've coupled the CFT to curvature. The decay in these orbits from the point of view of classical ADS physics is exponentially suppressed. What that means from the CFT side is that you have that in the black hole state, you're almost at resonance, right? Because the imaginary part is very small. So you're going to stick around for a long time, even in the conformal field theory. And then when you try to read stuff out, the readout with this insertion of these operators that are in the appropriate band will give you a large signal on the boundary when you measure for the presence of particles in the bulk. So the idea is that one of the problems that was being asked by Liu and Festuccia is what physics can access these metastable configurations. And here our operator insertions do exactly that. And the statement is that this result has to be non-perturbative from the point of view of the conformal field theory, basically because the answer is not a polynomial in the energy. It goes to zero at some energy, and it goes away from zero at some other energy, zero in the middle, and in the middle, it's exponentially suppressed. The only way to get an exponential in the energy of that type for the imaginary part is there's some resummation going on that tells you that you're in the appropriate window, and this is just not a polynomial. So there must be some non-perturbative effect in CFT that's responsible for this. I don't know what that effect is. The statement from gravity is that the presence of these stable orbits or metastable orbits are dual in the CFT to some non-perturbative effect in CFT, which should be available to us when the gravity calculation is valid, meaning probably requires large central charge, gap, and all the usual trappings of having some semi-classical bulk. Because this is pure classical gravity, presumably this is captured by the stress tensor conformal primary and its descendants and the multiparticle versions of it, which give you nonlinear gravity. So that's an answer. The answer is basically read out gravity and pretend that you know what's going on in the field theory. Okay. What's the true energy of these states? You take delta times E and you take the total angular moment of these states is delta times L. So as I said before, the geodesic bands depend on delta. That gives you how big they are. But the band in E and L depends only on this Euclidean time epsilon, but not on the dimension of the operator. So the idea is that for the same epsilon and the different operators, you always land in the same place in the Lorentzian black hole. So the regulator is geometric in that sense. And obviously we knew we had to regulate the physics on the CFT side, but the statement is that this regulator is actually geometric in that it really hones in on particular regions of the bulk directly. Okay. So I'm about done. So what's the conclusion? Does this regularized operators that source particles in the bulk geodesics directly, and they don't involve integrals over time. They involve this kind of excursion into Euclidean time for a while, and the insertions are at a point, and this is what we're doing. The interpretation is that they tunnel particles into the geodesics, and when we compare the Hamiltonian and the Lagrangian tunneling point of view, we found that there was a regulated geodesic length that was entering into the Hamiltonian computations. And basically, we can add or remove angular momentum by adding spherical harmonics on the boundary. And if you don't like spherical harmonics and you want to localize also on the angle, spherical harmonics fix the angular momentum in the quantum sense. You can poorly go to something with small uncertainty in the angular direction at some cost in the uncertainty in the angular momentum. For large mass particles, this should not matter, but for small mass particles, the uncertainty to the angular momentum will result into an uncertainty in the angle that you cannot avoid. Okay, now, the definition of these operators actually did not depend on knowing that we were in a black hole background. So in contrast to HKLL, where the kernel depends on the background in the bulk, the definition of these operators only depend on the Hamiltonian of the theory, not on the state that we started in. So in principle, they led you tunneling into other geometries that are more messy directly without having to modify anything. Okay. There's an interesting prediction for black hole backgrounds in the sense that we found this ISCOs. We had that the ISCOs are very far away from the horizon. They get pushed further and further away as the temperature goes up. Always you get this band of metastable operators. The band is there for both small and large black holes. And there's also these bands of inner geodesics that are inaccessible because of how we tunnel into the different geodesics. And then the parameters that we control on the Euclidean boundary make tunneling into these geodesics that are inside non-perturbatively suppressed. So if you actually just think about how likely are we to get lucky, we're not. Okay, so what's the next thing to do. Back to the question that Rob was saying, we need to understand this complex tunneling geodesics better, meaning how big is the imaginary angle, how big is the tunneling amplitude that we compute, does the regulator weight work the same way? Can we now go to rotating black holes and Kerr black holes and Myers-Perry black holes and all the zoology of black holes at higher dimensions and say interesting stuff? And the next step is also go back to this Festucci and Liu paper and understand the semi-classical quantization on these orbits much better. So what that means is you start on one of these circular orbits and you study the frequencies of the classical orbits around it, and you quantize them, and you try to understand the binding energy and the spectrum that these excitations have, and how that spectrum is affected by the presence of the black hole, and what are the shifts in energy relative to the insertions of particles with angular momentum that oscillate in pure ADS, and understand that stuff better. And that's it. Any questions?
Okay, thank you for the talk, David. We can take any questions if there are.
I'll chime in again.
Okay.
Do you know if I think about charge and charged black holes and charged particles, does any of this carry over, or how much of it would
carry? Sure. Anytime you have a charged particle, there'll be a charge, an effective potential that gets modified due to a charge. And then everything goes through. The only problem is getting particles whose classical mass scales like the classical charge, which you can do with BPS black holes or something like that, or with D-brains maybe.
I guess the other thing I was wondering about is that the angular momentum, the potential has a particular power that's fixed, whereas the charge is going to decay, the interaction there is going to decay more rapidly. And I just don't know what the interplay of the various powers was and how important that is.
If you take a charged black hole in higher dimensions, the decay of the black hole electric field is comparable to the decay of the gravitational field, because both of them are basically sourced by particles. So I would expect that the effect will actually compete for a particle whose charge is close to its mass in the right units.
Yeah.
Right.
Can I also ask you, you know, you were saying, you know, these things get pushed way out from the horizon, or the various quantities scaled much faster than the temperature.
Yes.
Which is a good thing. You know, they're way above all of the populated states, or they're in the region. How much do you really need then? I mean, do you need large C and strong coupling, or do you think you might be able to do it with large C, or? Let's say if we just wanted to find some of the stable orbits and not maybe the ISCO.
Let me tell you why I think we cannot do it with small coupling. So take my favorite model, which is an orbifold conformal field theory or some free field theory. And then all the operator dimensions of all the states are integers. And then when you look at the corrections that you get for these trajectories, you get a small fractional correction, which is not an integer. So it cannot be done at zero coupling. You need some amount of coupling. The second statement is that the contributions to the anomalous dimension are small, and then any other primary that has small dimension could probably compete with the multigraviton states, and you don't want to have too many of those around. So I think you are going to need a conformal field theory with a gap in dimensions.
Right. But even when you're doing large C stuff, there's always the caveat that nobody quotes that it's sort of like a gap. There aren't very many low dimension operators in the theory. Right.
So under good circumstances, if the next smallest dimension operator has a dimension which is bigger than the dimension of the stress tensor, because these things get pushed so far away, you're probably in good shape.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Probably. again, this is an issue of these things are going to be very suppressed relative to stress tensor exchange. So because these things are so far away from the black hole, in the large temperature limit, I would expect that in that case, you're going to be okay.
Okay. Thanks. I really enjoyed your talk. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. If you have any more questions, just send me an email and I'll try to answer. Some of this stuff hopefully will get published soon. And thank you all for having me.
Okay. Thank you, David, for the talk.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Bye.